When I think of UFOs in Brazil, I automatically think of Dr. Roger Lear. Matter of fact, he just finished a book called UFO Crash in Brazil. And so obvious, and we've been told a lot here, so obviously I think of Dr. Lear when the subject of Brazil comes up. And like the biggest news you could imagine breaking over the UFO community this night, we've got a story entitled Major UFO Breakthrough in Brazil. That's it. The Brazilians are going to open their UFO files to the world. And that's a pretty big story. I mean, imagine if it were the U.S. opening our files to the world. But Brazil, nevertheless, where there's been a hell of a lot of UFO activity, is just going to throw its files open. They have chosen people in ufology in Brazil to make these documents available to. And these people have been allowed into some of the most secret government installations in Brazil to receive this information. It is a pretty exciting story, to be sure. So who better to have on tonight? On the very day the story breaks, I called him up about it earlier, and Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear, author of Aliens and the Scalpel, has been said to be one of the world's most important leaders in physical evidence research involving the field of ufology. He and his surgical team have performed 9 surgeries on alleged alien abductees. This resulted in the removal of 10 separate and distinct objects suspected of being alien implants. These objects have been scientifically investigated by some of the most prestigious labs in the world. Their findings have been baffling, and some comparisons have been made to meteorite-like samples. Dr. Lear anticipates performing more surgeries in the future and will investigate the physiological and biological aspects of the abduction phenomenon. He has also formed a non-profit organization for this purpose called ANS Research, Inc. Here is Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening, Doctor. And, gee, your latest book, UFO Crash in Brazil, how it resonates with today's breaking news. Now, you tell him. I called you a couple hours, few hours before the show tonight and said, "Oh, look what's breaking in the news." And you said, "Well, that wasn't supposed to be out. That was supposed to be secret or something, right?"
Yeah, that's exactly what I said.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is that for some months now, I was privy to the information of what was going on in Brazil.
And you haven't been able to talk?
Haven't been able to talk about it. Sworn to secrecy. Secrecy.
Why? Why sworn to secrecy? I mean, if Brazil is going to open its files to the world, why should that be secret?
Well, it's not that it's a secret, is that what was going on was secret, because so many times, as you well realize, Art, in the strange field of ufology, people make claims to various things.
That's true.
Predictions and so on, and it never happens.
That's true.
So it was believed, you know, why upset the apple cart when these things were in the making and it looks like things were going to pan out. But
okay, I can buy that. Yeah, I can buy that. And you would keep it secret until, but here it is. Any idea of how it leaked out?
Yes, I know the whole story via A.J. Gerard, who's one of the leading ufological researchers in Brazil. I've worked with him many times over. I've been down there, as you know, many times, and he's set things up for me to investigate various aspects of ufology in Brazil. The individuals that were involved also, I know them all. They're all friends of mine, and very sincere investigators who absolutely have nothing to gain from any of the work. They're just very, very sincere. The first thing that happened was that AJ, through UFO Magazine Brazil, started a campaign to get the secrecy, you know, away from the government and where it belongs, you know, out to the people. So what he did was he started a petition drive through the magazine and got, thousands of signatures asking the government to release this information.
I know, but normally that results in a complete brick wall. I mean, you can hand them millions of signatures and nothing happens. Hold on. This is a good hook for everybody. But in this case, well, we'll find out. I wonder if the government was ready to do it anyway and they just used this as a sort of a, I don't know, look how responsive we are kind of deal to let it happen at this moment, or if they really did have that effect. I wonder. I mean, it's really a good question. Petition or not, if you delivered one to the U.S. government, they'd laugh in your face. So do you think the military was ready to do this anyway, and they just kind of took the opportunity to look responsive?
Well, Art, my life has gone from one synchronicity to another, so it's really hard to say. But look at it this way, you know, how many rocks you have to throw at the beehive before the bees attack?
Well, sometimes only one.
That's right. So here, you know, they didn't have what we have here. There's no Freedom of Information Act in Brazil. They don't have the opportunity to go through a government institution and ask for information as we are guaranteed to have here. Only to get it and have it 90% of it blacked out with a black pen, or now modernized whiteout. Though they don't have that at all.
Right.
So they were seeking, you know, some similar opportunity. Now with that, you know, you got to remember that, you know, on my website years ago, I put up a document that was signed by Daniel Golden from NASA with agreement with the Brazilians. And they were supposed to turn over any non-terrestrial material to us for further development. And then the Brazilians were guaranteed to share in the proceeds of the U.S. investigation development of those materials. So we've got to remember that. Then I have also documents as to how the government was supposed to handle UFOs, period, which was written way back in the 1960s. So you take all those factors, and then you ask the big question, what's going on now? Is it the government, or is it a branch of the government, like the Air Force? Now, I always remember Bob Dean's story about the fights that used to go on in Europe when the UFOs went over Europe, and they couldn't find out a doggone thing from the government. So the military got together, according to what Bob has to say, and did their own investigation. Well, how do we know that the Air Force, in this case, is not pretty sick about not being told what's going on? As a matter of fact, in a conversation that AJ had with one of the leading Air Force generals, is where this all started in the first place, he got a strange phone call. You know, and he was absolutely bowled over, thought it was a joke or, you know, somebody was after him. The general called and said that, you know, he would like to talk to him about the release of certain amounts of information. Well, AJ couldn't believe what he was hearing. So he, in another conversation, had told him that they were literally kept in the dark. I mean, they had the documents. They had, you know, all the reports, everything, and big investigations of three major UFO flaps in Brazil, ending with one in 1986, where there were literally thousands of UFOs and interactions occurring. And in one file alone, there's over 100 pictures, I understand. So AJ didn't know whether to believe it or not. So that's about the time when I began to hear about this information.
Yeah, I've heard about the 100 pictures. Let me stop you there. Do you have any sense of how important these photographs are, how detailed or how good they are, and what they are of?
Well, from what I've been able to understand as of late, they are wonderful. You know, Air Force photos taken of objects at varying distances, at varying speeds. There's documents indicating, you know, the radar sightings. There are evidently also photos taken from jets, with numerous jets were scrambled to chase these things.
You think they're clear, unambiguous photographs, Doctor?
Well, I haven't seen them, but from what I heard, you don't have to be a scholar to recognize these as disks.
I guess another question is, this is pretty big news. Do you think they really are releasing everything, or do you think they're doing a measured release and saying they're releasing everything? A question like that always has to be asked.
Well, it's speculative, but I know of the three cases and the three flaps that they're releasing information on, and they are the three biggest ones that were ever investigated by the Brazilian researchers. That's almost like saying, Art, well, let's take, the crash at Roswell and the Trent photos and a couple of other things, and we're going to release that to the public here in the U.S. and tell everybody all about it. So if you make that comparison, I think that, you know, these are three major things. It certainly is not everything.
Certainly it's not everything. So then it is measured.
I would say at this point it's measured, you know. Here comes my pessimistic view. We're all excited. I mean, I am really excited. I had a talk with Whitley today and explained a couple of things to him because he put it up on his website. It's probably on every website.
Sure as hell isn't going to hurt your book either, is it?
No. Again, another synchronicity, because we had planned this before this news ever broke. But here it is. You know, it's on the Internet. It's all over the Internet. You honestly think we're going to hear about this on CBS, NBC, ABC, or by Bill Riley?
You know, it's possible. I mean, this is a pretty big story. An entire nation decides to open UFO files. Yeah, I think it's a pretty big story. I think it's deserving of the nightly news.
Well, I certainly hope you're right.
No, I think so. I mean, look, even if it's a sort of last kicker story, for the general public, a whole country like Brazil opening their files, no, that's a big story.
I think it's big. I always thought that there was a possibility that some release of information could come out of Brazil, but I really expected that it would come out of a more renegade country like France, because I was over in France. They invited me to attend an SSE meeting over there, and strange thing happened there was that they almost canceled the meeting when they heard that I was going to be there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Very, very strange stuff. And then they wanted to know if I would appear at sort of a small secret meeting. And I did. And there was about 15 scientists there. Interestingly enough, including one member of the French Space Administration and one member of the Department of the Interior.
Gee whiz, Doctor. I'm recalling that not too many years ago, the French had this big committee of scientists who shocked the world by saying they believed that the evidence for UFOs justified a large government investigation, an official investigation, right?
Vis-a-vis the Comita report.
Yes. Yeah, so, why would they threaten to cancel a meeting just because you would show your face?
Oh, it wasn't the government that threatened to cancel the meeting. It was the SSE, because they considered me a heretic.
Heretical in what way?
Well, here I am talking about a subject on UFOs, and you're talking about the, you know, very famous worldwide academics who, you know, are talking about astrophysics and chemistry and all the little subjects, and here's a guy coming to talk about UFOs, so, you know.
Well, you are a doctor, though.
That's true.
And you've done actual gathering of physical evidence by removing things from people.
Yeah, here's the strange thing. You know, when I speak about these things, my information doesn't come from me. You know, I didn't have dreams that I submitted these things to a laboratory. These are reports that are coming from the scientists themselves.
Huh, well.
So maybe that's what they took in consideration, because the data, you know, the data is sort of overwhelming, so they probably, a number of them, obviously, if they didn't want me there, they wouldn't have invited me or paid for my ticket.
Indeed. I was also curious about a little something I read in there, that some of what you have removed, when examined, has been compared to meteorite material.
That's correct.
In what sense?
Well, some of the metallurgy looks like a meteorite. You know, a large amount of them contain iron, for example, and they contain nickel, and they contain other things that are found in meteorites. But the perplexing thing that came forth out of the scientist who rendered this opinion was that the nickel-iron ratio wasn't quite right for a meteorite. Well, you got to remember, too, Art, that all these things that we sent out are blind studies. They're not... nobody's told where they come from. They could have fallen off of the back of a camel for all they know.
Huh. All right. I guess we should take the time and trouble to roll over what you know and have experienced in Brazil. I know it's a pretty good-sized story, but, I mean, we should give people a sense of the magnitude of the stories that are going to be broken open officially in Brazil. And you can do that.
Yes. We can. We're talking about, of course, the very famous Varginha case of 1996, and how this case today, in my opinion and others also, represents something that's even more important than Roswell. Now, my gosh, who am I to say anything like that, since Roswell is, the United States phenomena that we've all been talking about for many, many, many years. Several reasons in comparison. One, both involve the crash of what appears to be a non-terrestrial vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
In the Roswell case, there's a lot of emphasis that's placed on the vehicle. Where it crashed, how it crashed, did it crash alone or with two other vehicles, one in Socorro and the other possibly in the plains of St. Augustine. A lot of emphasis placed on the crash, the material, the debris field, and all that sort of stuff.
That's right.
But in the Brazil case, there's not much emphasis placed on the crash, which occurred actually the night of January the 19th, 1996. A farmer saw something that was coming down with smoke or vapor sort of coming out of one end of it, and he looked at it and he saw that there was evidently a piece missing. So he got quite curious, didn't know whether this was some military thing or whatever it was.
Well, if he could make a judgment that there was a piece missing, that means he saw enough detail of the craft to understand the symmetry of it and see some part of that missing, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a cylindrical craft, and as I said, he couldn't tell whether it was the front end or the back end, but from the direction it was going, it looked like it was the after end, and it was releasing smoke or vapor or whatever you call it. But it did fly around for a while until it finally impacted with the field. And he watched the impact occur, and there was a lot of debris also from this piece. The largest piece left over was about the size of a Volkswagen bus. But almost immediately, the Brazilian military, the army, was there. And they saw him and his truck, and they asked him quite strongly to leave. Well, Brazilians, for many, many years have had a different kind of government than we've had. It's kind of a jackbooted thug government they had up until the late 50s when the Brazilian Civil War came about. And so he didn't react the way they told him. He pulled around the corner.
All right, hold it right there. Doctor, last night I interviewed a truck driver who had some lights following him disagreeably over his truck for quite a period of time. He finally got fed up with it, pulled his truck over at a stop, pulled out his .45 and pumped several slugs into these damn things that were just above his truck. I advised him against shooting at UFOs. However, you describe something coming down, smoke trailing it, with an apparent piece missing. You don't suppose it was shot at, do you?
Ooh, could that be a possibility? I'm sorry if I gave the impression that this was a disc. It wasn't a disc. It was a cylindrical-shaped craft.
That's fine.
So now that we got that cleared up, yeah, a piece missing out of it, smoking.
Right.
And then we find out from the Brazilian investigators later on that it was NORAD that notified the Brazilian military when this was coming down and exactly where it was coming down.
Well, we know that NORAD can track things in space right down to the nuts and bolts that are loose and in orbit, so NORAD would be able to notify them that something like that was occurring. That accounts for the Brazilian military being on hand. Now, I'm sure their story, our story, NORAD's story, would be that it was re-entering space junk.
Space junk, exactly. Space junk flying around, going here, going there, and finally crashing.
How did I guess?
Now, the recovery operation consisted of several military trucks, and they went to the area, saw the large piece, which I understand was about the size of a Volkswagen bus.
All of this now, according to the farmer who watched.
Right.
Okay.
And what they did was they eventually brought in a crane because this thing was too heavy to lift up on the back of one of their trucks. So once the large piece was removed, it was reported that they spread out about hand in hand and made their way across the field with metal detectors and garbage bags and picked everything up, threw all the bags in the back of these trucks, and they went on their happy, merrily little way.
Mm.
Now, it just so happens that this, as I said, was the night of February the 19th. On February the 20th, I have to say that one of the things I tried to do in the book was to eliminate the rumors from what was fact as obtained by the Brazilian researchers and directly from the witnesses.
Okay.
In fact, I labeled a whole chapter in the book rumors. In other words, these were unsubstantiated things. So what I'm going to talk about is only the things that we know because of either very sincere investigation or eyewitness testimony. So the following morning, at 8 o'clock in the morning, a Brazilian contingency was seen not too far from that area and engaged in a rather strange activity. And were officers from the intelligence service went down an embankment and captured a being which was described by numerous people as being relatively short, between 4 and 5 feet tall, having a body that was brown-skinned, very oily, large red eyes.
My God, Doctor, the witnesses that said all of this, were they actually watching the military capture this being, or was this a description?
Oh, yes. They were all watching. We have people like carpenters who are up on a roof doing their work and turned around and saw they were attracted by the military and saw them go down the embankment. We have people who are riding bicycles. I mean, just people all over the place.
Holy
happen.
Smokes. All right, so if all of this is it your anticipation that all of this is going to be released in the documents the Brazilian government now promises to unleash on the world?
Well, so far, I don't know if anything is being released on the Farginha case, and that may be because there was definitely U.S. military involvement with this case.
Uh-huh.
The ones that are solely involved with the Brazil happenings there, in which the U.S. Didn't have much to do with, that might be the information that's released. But we know so much about the Varginha case now, there's really not much that the Brazilian government can release. We probably know as much as they do.
Because I was going to say, if we get those kind of photographs, my God, it's all over.
Well, you got to start somewhere, and we can only hope by the time that it's all done, if it all comes out, we're going to know everything that transpired for many, many years in Brazil, and probably not too much different than what occurred in other places in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, if they actually released this, I mean, for example, photographs of the being, were they to release that, it's over. So tell me the rest of the story. I mean, the army captures this being, and describe it again, please.
Less than 5 feet tall, brown in color, very smooth, the skin, kind of oily, large head, big red eyes, kind of upturned at the end, no hair, and three little protuberances on the top of the head going from the front to the back, one on each side, one in the middle. Beings evidently didn't make any noise, as far as we know, but there were some individuals who said that they heard a sound like a buzzing sound. So we got two different types of testimony in reference to whether they made any sounds. Now, that occurred on January the 20th at 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, around 8 p.m., two military intelligence service officers captured another creature that was trying to cross the street. And this creature was injured. And we talked about him on the last show. What
yes.
happened? We'll go over briefly that again.
Please.
But in the middle, between 8 a.m., when the military contingent captured a creature going down in the woods, and 8 p.m. when the one was picked up crossing the street, three girls, young teenage girls, on their way home from work, taking a shortcut, saw something kneeling by a concrete block wall. And as they got closer to it, they thought it was a child. And approaching it even closer, they got a better look. Mm-hmm. And they saw, again, the creature that we previously described. It was kneeling at this wall. And when the first girl saw it, she thought she'd seen the devil.
Kneeling.
It was kneeling.
That's a kind of a submissive posture, really.
Definitely. And when she saw it, as I said, she thought she'd seen the devil. And she screamed and turned around and ran home. Now, the other girl was right on her heels, but she stayed a little bit longer. She stayed long enough to see that the creature turned around, turned his head, and looked at her.
Yes.
And that made her as terrified as the first young girl, and she turned around. The third girl also looked at the creature, and so the three of them ran home. Now, two of these were sisters, and one was a friend. They informed the mother of what happened, and the mother, who didn't have an automobile, ran to the neighbors and got the neighbor to drive her back to the spot where the girls saw this being, and by that time there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly enough, when I was there, I've got a good gauge of the distance between where the girls saw this creature kneeling, and where the two military police officers picked up this creature trying to cross the street.
How much distance?
Not much. In fact, I have some video footage and photos standing on the corner where the police officers, the military intelligence officers, picked up this being. And I could look up the street and see exactly the wall where the girl saw it. So it was probably the same creature, didn't get too far. Now, some rumors have it, you know, that as many as 11 creatures were seen around Varginha at various times. But for sure, what we know, again, from eyewitness testimony, is that there were two. Now, there was another episode that occurred a little bit later in the morning, where again a military contingent and the fire department came to the same area where the first creature was captured at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
And again, eyewitnesses watched both the fire department and the army from a base called Sergeant's Camp, which was not that far away, watch their activities. Some report a little bit of an argument going on as to maybe whose province this was.
Uh-huh.
Now, the fire department in Brazil is a branch of the military service. It's not like what we have here.
Right.
And they're engaged in a number of different operations, which can be military and civilian. They can capture a wild animal, put out a fire. They can also rescue, air rescue or sea rescue floods and so on. And then yet they carry rifles and they are a part of the military. So here was two different branches of the military evidently having an argument with each other about something to do with the capture of one of these creatures. Now, as I stood on this construction overhang, which now exists at the same spot, I was able to look down on the hill where all this took place. And the military people had to climb over a fence and down a rather steep embankment.
Mm-hmm.
And once they got to the bottom, there was a railroad track. And they had to cross the railroad track, all this, mind you, continually going downhill, until they got to this little small field. And then adjoining the field was a wooded area. Well, they chased this creature into the wooded area. Now, at this point, witnesses say that two shots rang out. And in a few minutes, two of the Brazilian army representatives came out, each carrying a sack over his shoulder. In one sack, there were movements seen, like something kicking. The other sack, there was no movement whatsoever. They struggled to carry the sacks and what they had with them, their gear, back up the hill. It took them quite some time until they got there. Then these sacks were emptied into two different boxes on the trucks, and the trucks were covered with a canvas overlay, and off they went to Sergeant's Camp.
Holy smokes.
So, not too nice a picture. Now, the story of Virginia gets very, very complex, and we have to sort of take it apart each at a time. Let's go first to the military intelligence officers who captured the being that was trying to cross the street.
Yes.
Now, one of these police officers, a young man, Marco Eli Charizzi, very healthy, young Brazilian military person, went out from the car while his companion stayed in the car, and he put his arm around this creature, but he wasn't wearing any protective gear. He wasn't wearing any gloves. And he assisted the creature into the car, got in, and set him on his lap. Then they drove off.
Set the creature on?
Set the creature on the military officer's lap.
Now this is all testimony from the officer involved?
Testimony from the officers, the other officer, eyewitnesses to the scene.
Holy smokes.
Ubijara Rodriguez, who is a labor attorney in Brazil with his offices in Virginia, and also a 36-year investigator, has done a full case study.
I would think anybody who had a alien creature on their lap would be able to give an incredibly detailed description.
I'll bet he could, too. The only thing is that within 3 weeks, he was dead.
Dead?
Dead.
Of?
Dead of unknown causes until just recently.
What? Excuse me? You mean the cause was just recently discovered?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
One of the witnesses that I interviewed was the wife of the deceased military police officer, young man Marco Eli Sharesi.
That healthy young officer.
Healthy young man, deceased. And the interview that I did with the wife was the most unusual interview that I have ever done with anyone, because she couldn't answer any of the questions that I asked her. Absolutely none.
Like what?
What were the symptoms that your husband had before he was taken to the hospital? She said, I don't know. I said, did you visit your husband in the hospital? Yes, but they wouldn't let me see him. What kind of symptoms do you think he had when he was in the hospital? I don't know. And on and on and on and on. Were you given the medical records? No. Were you given the cause of death? No. Were you given a death certificate? No. Do you receive any subsistence from the Brazilian military? No. Do you receive any subsistence at all from the Brazilian government? No. Do you have children? Yes. Then how do you exist? I don't know. Now, just from that alone, and standing there talking to this lady with an interpreter, I mean, it didn't take too much. You didn't have to be a rogue scholar to realize that this woman had been severely intimidated. She was going to tell nothing. In contrast, Marco's sister gave a pretty good report to a British television station, and she described the symptoms of Marco Eli Sharesi in great detail.
And said what?
And said that he started complaints with an abscess under the armpit. He had a fever. Finally, he had trouble breathing, extreme pain in his back, and nobody seemed to know what was wrong with him. Now, that remained that way until August of last year, right before I almost finished the book. And I was able to get a report and include it almost in the last chapter of the book, because an individual came forth, a Dr. Cesario Lincoln Furtado,
yes,
came forth and told how he was the doctor who was in charge of the treatment of Marco Eli Sharesi.
Did he talk to you, physician to physician?
No, I did not talk to him. I was here, and A.J. And Ubejar Rodriguez talked to him in Brazil. Sent me all the data, very exacting data that they got out of him, and I can give the whole chronology of what happened until this person died.
Now, is it a fair assumption that whatever the affliction was, it was precipitated by contact, that kind of contact?
I believe so, because the net result was he had a compromised immune system, and they couldn't find any bacteria. They flooded him with antibiotics, but there was no bacteria that were ever found, so I think we're talking about virology, and the poor guy probably had viremia, and what I can put together from the symptoms...
Doctor, hold it, right. Nice hook location, actually. So he had an alien on his lap. And then a previously healthy person begins to lose, or instantly loses, his immune system. So the wife of this military man knows nothing she's willing to share, and the doctor does. The doctor apparently on the case from the very beginning, Dr. Lear, and right through it, or what?
Yes, Dr. Furtado.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to give you several pieces of facts here. Names don't really are not that important, but just it kind of helps to...
If you know the names, I'd just as soon hear them.
Yeah, it's kind of like a building going up. I mean, the nails are necessary to the total sum of the building.
Yes.
So we have a Dr. Armando, who is a general surgeon, and the hospital he saw the patient in was Hospital Regional, which is a fairly good-sized hospital in downtown Virginia. We have a Dr. Rene, who is a cardiologist, again, Hospital Regional. We have a Dr. Cesario Lincoln Furtado, who is the person I just mentioned, cardiologist He was at the hospital Bon Pasteur, which is not, again, that far away. Then we have a Dr. Rogério Limos, an orthopedic surgeon, a hospital Bon Pasteur, again. And then we have Alberto Severo de Piva, another orthopedic surgeon who is at the hospital Regional. So it's easy to see now.
Are you telling me all of these doctors had a hand in the case? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes, they all saw the patient at two different hospitals.
Okay.
So there's no way in the world that you can see that this gentleman didn't get the very best of care. Now, here's the way it went. On January the 20th, 1996, Officer Shazeri takes part in the capture of the creature. Then after a few days, he develops a little tumor similar to a furuncle, you know, like a little boil. And this appears in the armpit. It's becomes abscessed, and it was drained. This was done at the hospital Bon Pasteur. On February the 12th, he arrives at the hospital Regional, and he's taken from there almost immediately to hospital Bon Pasteur with severe pains in his back. And there he was seen by the cardiologist, Dr. Rene.
Hmm.
Examinations were carried out, and two antibiotics were prescribed and administered. One was penicillin, and the other was gentamicin.
Suspecting what?
Suspecting some kind of a urinary tract infection, which it was going to supposedly produce the pain in his back.
Okay.
February the 13th, the following day, his health status diminishes, and he continues to remain quite unstable. On the 14th, the officer spends a day in the hospital all day long with a fever, severe pains in his back, some difficulty breathing. They thought he had pneumonia. They didn't understand why the antibiotics weren't taking effect.
Hmm.
February the 15th, he awakens. He's tired, fatigued. He feels generalized numbness. And begins to show a subcyanosis, which is, the skin changing color because of the lack of oxygen. And this is most characterized as what we call a bacteremia, with that means that there's bacteria that's, circulating in the blood, and a possible septicemia. Now, septicemia is different than a bacteremia, because septicemia means that there are toxins coming from somewhere that are circulating in his blood.
Got it.
So he's transferred again now back to ICU at Hospital Regional, and there he was examined and received some stabilizing medication.
Are they doing blood work trying to figure out what the toxins are?
Yes, they're doing blood work, and you're getting the results back. They even did an HIV test. Now, why would you do an HIV test, Mark?
Well, I mean, you did say immune-like collapse.
Sure. That means that without saying it, you suspect some kind of a viremia. Not a bacteremia, not a septicemia, but a viremia.
Yes.
And, there's some virus that's now attacking the poor guy's immune system. So those tests came back negative. No, sure, it was negative for HIV. And after a six-hour stay in the ICU unit, he died. Cause of death not mentioned. All the records sealed. Private, supposedly, funeral by the military. Wife was not allowed to be there.
Don't they have to list the cause of death? Or is Brazil not like America in that regard? They just say, well, he died.
Brazil. They do not have to do anything they don't want to do. Cause of death, unknown.
Uh-huh.
In less than 20 days, three bacteria attacked the officer who was written. One was in his arm some days before he was cured. Afterwards, he had a urinary tract infection with Enterobacter. Now, that came back from the lab reports. That, they say, he caused his death, which was a lie. There was also another infection in his lungs. That is, another bacteria. And this is all indicated by Dr. Furtado. Now, when you look at the lab reports, which I have done, and you take that with the testimony of his sister, you got a whole different picture, because his sister describes these high spiking fevers, his thirst, loss of appetite, emaciated appearance, strange color in skin, and what's more important, what she describes, engorgement of his eyes with blood.
Oh, my God.
Now, is there anything?
And all of this...
remind you of anything, Art? Did you ever hear what the symptomatology of an Ebola infection
was? I was going to say that, or Marburg, something like that, sort of bleed out. Gee, I don't know where to begin here. What was done with his body?
Well, it was supposedly buried, and they're trying to get the body interned. But guess what? They're having a lot of difficulty doing that. And I've got a sneaking suspicion there is no body. Because, not just trying to keep the fact that maybe a UFO crashed with alien beings running around town, but maybe one of them had a terrible viral infection, an Ebola-like infection. Don't you think that's a good reason to put the hat on this? My God, you'd have scared everybody to death.
Yes, I would say it would be a very good reason, because that would mean any contact, perhaps with it, one of these aliens or any alien, could result in what you just described. And all of this came down on an apparent very healthy man who was how old?
23 years old.
In how many days? 20 days?
Well, yeah, roughly 20-some-odd days, less than 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'd say that would be a reason to put a hat on this, all right?
Now, I'm sure you've heard this over and over and over again, like beating a drum. Why don't they come down and shake hands with you? Land on the White House lawn.
Well?
Yeah, land on the White House lawn, shake hands with Bush, and everybody in the country's dead in less than a month from a bacteria. And what movie depicted that? War of the Worlds.
Yeah? God. Did the doctor offer any private observations or suspicions beyond, what came back in the lab tests about,
Well, here's what he had to say. I can read it to you verbatim. Despite the antibiotics, the infection was getting worse. After his death, his body was taken for an autopsy, which revealed a urinary tract infection caused by Enterobacter that was confirmed by examinations at Hospital Bon Pasteur. There was also a lung infection and small pneumonia. There could have been a congenital immunodeficiency. Is that a laugh? Congenital immunodeficiency
congenital.
Of a 23-year-old, young, healthy military fellow?
Yeah, congenital. No, that doesn't...
But he goes on to say, but he didn't have that, otherwise he wouldn't have gotten to be 23 in good health. I find that amusing.
And so that's how he ends it?
No, he says his chance of dying when he was a boy was much higher. Any kind of disease can kill a person with immunodeficiency. So he didn't have that for sure, or at least... he didn't have immunodeficiency the day he died. For this reason, the immunodeficiency, was surely acquired. How he acquired that, no one knows. I say the cause of death was not found because it wasn't pneumonia or the urinary tract infection and the abscess that killed him. We still don't know what the cause.
That's
the most amusing thing.
Normally, the World Health Organization or CDC or whatever would fly personnel in for that kind of thing, wouldn't they?
Oh, I would think so. But again, you're dealing with Brazil. It's just marvelous to find a hospital that even has an ICU. Now, the two doctors that came for us and talked in this case, the other one was an orthopedic surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to quarantine or cordon off one section of the same hospital, which was Hospital Regional, where this being was treated, which, we can go into next. So here we have the guy that sort of saves his butt, takes him to the hospital. First, incidentally, I don't know what I mentioned, he was taken to a first aid station. And he was examined, and they decided they couldn't do anything with the poor guy. So that's when they took him to Hospital Regional, And then comes the doctor I interviewed, who was there in the hospital and saw a gradual influx of military people.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that this wasn't surprising because the military would bring in, you know, injured victims from time to time from whatever they had happened on the base. And so to see military people in the hospital was not surprising. But as the night wore on, there was more of them, and they actually cordoned off a section of the hospital. So,
Do you think the suspicion was that there was other contact and there were just others that had proximity that were getting checked out? Is that what you think?
Now, this is a very good question, and that's the question that I put to the Brazilian researchers not long after I heard the report from Dr. Furtado. And he says that according to military witnesses, and you got to remember, military stints in Brazil are not like they are here. They're much shorter. These people go in, they do their thing, and they're out. And once they're out, they blab, they talk. Evidently, there were more people who were getting sick that reported, you know, to the military medical unit there. And there's also some suspicion that some civilians also became ill.
Uh-huh.
That's all we know now. But as I said, you know, we were making comparison between Roswell and and this case.
And now you say that the hospital was portion of it was cordoned off.
That's correct. It was cordoned off by military personnel and restricted, and not even the medical personnel were allowed in and out of the area. Excuse me. Once the control was put on, then it was off limits to all personnel in the hospital. And as I understand of it, part of this was the surgery and the maternity unit, where they had more space.
Uh-huh. This is just an astounding story, isn't it?
Oh, it is, in all aspects. And, you know, writing the book, which took me quite some time, and discussing it even in the time that we have on the air, we're only highlighting a few of the features of the case. So, you know, if someone is interested, and I certainly can't see why they wouldn't be, they've got to get a book and, you know, read what's in there, because I've got almost the latest information.
Let me pull all the way back to the crashing vehicle with the piece missing and smoke. Do you think, Doctor, that it's worth speculating that the United States shot at this thing, and that NORAD damn well knew where it was going to come down, because they were tracking it after we did whatever we did?
Well, after being involved for as long as I've been involved in this field, and, you know, not just running out of the pumpkin patch, here's, for example, President Reagan going gung-ho for this Star Wars thing.
Yes.
At a time where we have no particular mortal enemies here that are going to attack us. The Cold War is winding down to an end. The Soviet Union is folding up like a clam. And he's out pushing, you know, Star Wars.
Well, actually, he pushed it before the Soviet Union collapsed like a clam.
Yeah, well, he did. He was, you know, it was an inspiration during that time. But I'm saying he pushed it, but it was still pushed after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Quite right. And actually is still being pushed today. I've read, I don't know how many stories recently, about the U.S. weaponizing space. It's a big, really big topic right now. And our military basically is saying, yeah, we're going to essentially weaponize space. We have to protect. In fact, one of the quotes was that if U.S. satellites were taken out of commission, it would bring the United States to its knees. So, will we weaponize space to protect our assets? I think so.
Well, we can weaponize our space to protect our assets, or we can protect, as Reagan alluded to, something. It's either something without or something within. And if they got some pointed, you know, in a different direction, you know, it may be protection, but it's protection from what?
Yes. Well, My advice to the president and to the military would be the same as I gave to a man last night on the air. And that is that, gee, I don't know, a race of intelligent beings that could cross light years to get to us, probably you shouldn't shoot at them. Because if they could, if they had that technology, that, and we, you know, upset them, it seems like they could, I don't know, sterilize the world.
Well, even if they don't have that intent, and their intent is quite benign, and you do shoot at them, I think, you know, by all means, they certainly have a right to defend themselves. But, you know, it always amuses me that we look at non-terrestrial beings in the strict sense that there's some, you know, organized affair like in Star Trek, the Federation of Planets. How do we know, for example, that Joe Kluck on planet Zig, about, oh, in this neighborhood, only about 4 light years away, gets the weekend off? And he says to the wife, hey, I'm going to go down to Joe's saucer lot. I'm going to rent a saucer, grab the kids.
Head
look,
for Earth.
We'll pack
weekend.
A lunch.
Yeah.
We're about this crazy little blue planet out there in one of the arms of the Milky Way.
Yeah, and we're going to do a flyby.
Yeah, we'll hang there for the weekend. I hear they kill themselves. They not only do that, but they destroy the planet. We'll put on the cloaking device. We'll hang around. We'll have lunch. We'll have a ball. We'll come home.
Maybe, Doctor. Hold it right there. Dr. Lear, Don in New York, New York, obviously listening to the mighty station I grew up with, WABC 77 in New York, says, obvious question, Art, why would somebody, anybody, put a creepy-looking alien on their lap? It is a good question.
I don't... I don't know, really know if I have an answer to that, but you know, when you're in the military, you do what you're supposed to do.
Well, I know, but there are limits and legal orders and crazy orders. And if somebody said to me, see that alien, that encrusted whatever, put it on your lap while we go wherever we're going. I'm sorry, sir, that doesn't sound like a lawful nor smart order to me.
Well, looking at it that way, you know, you can either follow orders or not, and we don't even know if he had an order to do anything. But in going over the doctor's testimony, he never found the alien creepy or crusty or any such thing.
Maybe he thought it was cute. I don't know. I mean, it is a good question, though. I mean, yeah, you're right. They didn't say creepy looking, but not human, so it's creepy in a way, sort of.
Well, even the girls that I interviewed, one was very adamant about this being an intelligent creature. She didn't know what it was.
Yeah, but it scared the hell out of her.
It scared the hell out of her because she associated it with the devil. Each one of the three girls had different impressions of what they saw, and I was able to do interviews with two of them. Now, there are other individuals that have gone there. Late Dr. John Mack was there. He interviewed the girl.
I recall his trip there, yes.
And it was his impression that they were certainly telling the truth. I didn't go there with the purpose of trying to decide whether they were telling the truth. I went there, as I said originally, looking for physical evidence. But the interviews with the girls I wanted to do from another reason. And I'm surprised that Dr. Mack didn't do it. I wanted to know if they or the mother had some relationship to the abduction phenomena. And I found some rather strange things in that note. But the second girl, who was the youngest, as I stated originally, stood there a couple of seconds longer and noticed that the being turned around and looked at her. And I questioned her as to, you know, why she thought this was something other than an animal. I said, are you sure this was not an animal? You know, I realize you live, it's not too far from where wild animals are seen. And she says, no, this was not an animal. I mean, she was absolutely adamant. Mm-hmm. And I said, did you think that this this creature or whatever it was you saw had intelligence? And she said, absolutely. Now, she was the only one of the three that said that. But as I said, she saw him turn his head and look directly at her. The experience that the orthopedic surgeon had, which we can talk about again later, certainly proves that this was not an animal. And again, as I said, it was not creepy and not crusty. And
well, let's talk about that. He's a surgeon, so he should know quite a bit about what it was we were dealing with, or at least, I don't know, have professional opinions.
Yes, and I think when I went there, I received a reception from the very beginning that was quite extraordinary to me. The plane landed at a very small airport, and there was no security at this day and age, which was quite surprising at all.
They were aware of your arrival, though.
Evidently. The stairs were rolled up to the plane, and we were sitting in the back. I was there with my friend, another doctor, who had agreed to go and do some of my filming for me. And so the rest of the passengers on the plane got up and got off before we did, and we grabbed the bags that we had. And we started walking off the plane. As we started going off, we noticed that there was a crowd of people. I mean, people poured out of this little terminal to come up to the plane. And I tell you the truth, I was kind of scared.
Doctor, with that kind of a reception, wouldn't you also be perhaps concerned about the possibility of a setup? I mean, it sounds as though it almost could be planned.
Oh, yeah, there were numerous things that went through my mind. I mean, number one, like I said, there was no security there. I'd like to see you land in the smallest airport in the United States in some kind of a commercial liner and have people just bust out of the terminal and run out to the runway.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. So,
yes, you're allowed to. In fact, they don't even have transport airplanes in a lot of countries. You just walk right up, you know, on the runway, you walk right up the tarmac and to the steps and go up the plane. That's it.
Well, these were people who were greeting an arriving plane.
Yeah.
You just don't do that. So, I was kind of shook up. Who knows what was going on? Maybe I was going to be arrested when I walked down the stairs. But the first thing that happened was that, someone stuck out their hand and started shaking hands with me, and another fellow popped up as the interpreter and told me that the gentleman that I had just shook hands with was the mayor. me? Who in the heck am I to receive a reception from a mayor of a city?
I don't know. You tell me. I mean, what was the excitement?
I don't know. Still to this day. I mean, the word obviously got out that I was coming to Virginia, and I don't know what kind of preparation they had made. But this is a little town now who has become quite famous for this event that occurred, and they're just realizing. Today, I understand that, that perhaps they can make a couple of bucks from getting tourists to go there. This is not a tourist town. You don't go to Virginia. You go there if you want to do something with agriculture or farming.
All right, but this could be a motive, though, for staging an entire event, and maybe you, as great American ufologist, coming to investigate this and validate it, make it a very important place that people would want to visit. I don't know. I can see you'd be very welcome. That's what I guess I meant by a setup.
Yeah, well, it's possible. But again, I don't know today. All I do know is what happened after I got there. And the people started coming forth that would volunteer to talk to me that wouldn't talk to anybody before. And one of them was this physician that was at Hospital Regional. And he didn't want to talk to me as a UFO researcher. I think he just wanted to talk to me because I was a colleague, and there was nobody else for him to talk to for 6 years.
Right.
So the interview was probably one of the most emotional events that ever occurred to me in my life. Here's a guy who starts out by telling us that all this was rumors. These were things that he'd heard from his friends and colleagues in the hospital. He had no first-hand knowledge of any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then winds up at the end of the interview sitting in a chair with his hand shaking, his head lowered, and tears running down his cheeks. So, you know, that's disclaimer at the beginning was absolute nonsense. One of the things I found at the beginning when I was introduced to him, he spoke almost no English, and I don't speak that much Portuguese. And he asked me to come with him privately, and he took me into one of the examining rooms, and he had a patient on the table who had a fracture of a foot with x-rays up on the view box, and he motioned for me to look at the foot and look at the x-rays, and I was very happy to oblige. And during that session where we went ahead and I assisted him in putting a cast on the foot, we were able to talk in medical terminology.
For sure.
Which was almost the same, whether it was English or Portuguese or whatever else.
I'm sure that's right, yes.
So we had a common bond before the actual formal part of the interview ever began. So most of the information I was getting from Ubirajara's son, Rodolfo, who was fluent in English, but when it came to the medical aspects, they probably understood a lot less than I did.
Well, what brought this man to tears?
Well, he talked from the beginning the happenings of that night and how he saw an increase in military personnel in the hospital. And he didn't really think that much of it because sometimes they brought in accident cases from the base and so on. But he saw something that he felt was sort of strange. The military personnel were guarding certain doorways, and the hospital and civilian personnel were not allowed to go in or out. But he just went on doing what he usually does. At one point, he was asked by two military police officers to accompany him, and he was taken into the wing that they had cordoned off. And this part of it was the surgery suite. And he was asked to scrub for a case. And when he inquired as to what kind of a case it was, they wouldn't tell him anything. So he did, and he finished his scrub gown and then went into the surgical room, and there was a military guard on the outside, on the door. And basically, he was told not to come out until the job was done.
Okay.
Not knowing what the job was supposed to be or what he was supposed to do there. So he looked at the patient on the table, and the patient was covered up with a drape sheet, and he was still doing his preparation. They had x-rays up on a view box, and he said, well, you know, he thought it was a child with some sort of a fracture because he is an orthopedic surgeon.
Okay.
So he looked at the x-rays, and he told me the first thing that he saw was... he recognized the bone structure, and this would have been the femur, which is the bone in the thigh. But when he was looking at it, he thought that the victim had severe osteoporosis because he saw these large, what do you call, lacunae in the bones, the cavities in bone, like sometimes you find in an older person who has severe osteoporotic bone. That he didn't quite understand. So...
So did he go as far as to suggest that it didn't look human, or just human with disease?
Well, the bone looked human, but with disease. With peculiarities.
Okay.
And then they went over to the table, and they pulled the drape sheet back, and he looked at this thing's face, and I guess he was akin to falling over. He knew that it wasn't human, and he knew that it wasn't some kind of deformity that he had ever seen before. But it was some kind of a bipedal creature, two arms and two legs. And he described it as being less than 5 feet tall. The skin was brown and what he called reticulated. And
what does that mean?
He explained this as seeing outlines of, like, large scales. But then when he went to touch the skin, of course, he was all gloved, so he was protected. But he said the skin was very smooth, and you couldn't feel any demarcation between this scaly-like appearance. The skin was very, very smooth.
That's interesting. A scaly area that look, or it looks scaly, but to touch it, the same as the rest of the skin.
Right. And the body was hairless, no hair on the head, the arms, on the torso. They had the color was brown and the skin was oily, and there was a set of external blood vessels like varicose veins that coursed up the shoulders and did not go up into the neck, but were only on the shoulders. The head was, he said, quite large in proportion to the torso, and the face had two large upturned eyes that were red in color, but he did not want to look this creature in the eye.
Oh, I've never liked red eyes.
And he said, I asked him why, and he said he really didn't know. He just didn't want to look it in the eye. And but what he did see was that the eyes looked like two pools of liquid, and gave this very strange feeling, which made him, you know, definitely not want to look it in the eye at all. On the top of the head were three protuberances that ran from the front above the forehead to the back that stuck out about an inch.
Yeah, you mentioned that before. You mean like bone protrusions?
Yeah, bone protuberances running across the head from the front to the back, one on each side and one right across the middle.
Maybe that made that girl think it was devil-like, or...
I think so, because, you know, you picture the devil with horns.
Exactly.
The color and the red eyes and so on, that's probably what gave him the impression of
red
the devil.
Red eyes, very bad.
So, a very little mouth, no particular nose, no... nothing that he considered, you know, ears, no pina, the outside, you know, fleshy part of our ears. The neck was thin and looked like it couldn't support the head well. The torso was that, he said, of like a child. He says the arms were emaciated, very thin, long. Hands went down to about the lower center of the thighs. The hands had four fingers, and the fingers, he said, could articulate with each other. In other words, you could take the second finger and make it work with the fifth finger. There was no opposed thumb, and he said mechanically a hand that operated in this manner didn't need a thumb.
Was he absolutely convinced at this point that he was looking at a non-human, or did he have some, or imagine in some way he was looking at a deformed human?
No, I asked him that specifically, and after he saw the face and neck...
no doubt?
He had no doubts in his mind that this was not a human being. Then he went on to... again, he described how the fingers worked, and he didn't know whether they were multi-jointed fingers or whether they were composed of some kind of a soft cartilage that could bend. But he said the hand could do anything that we could do with our hand without the use of a thumb. He said there was no navel, there was no umbilicus, no belly button, there was no external genitalia seen. The legs, he said, were quite muscular and short, and there was a normal looking knee without a visible patella, that's the kneecap. He didn't really see a kneecap. And we got down to the foot, the legs just sort of went into the foot without the normal appearance of a human ankle. He talked about the toes, there being three large, very fleshy toes with no toenails. But he described another appendage, which came off the center portion, like if you're looking at your foot, the mid-arch area, the side of the arch, and there was an appendage that he called a vestigial appendage. Now, I don't know where he got that idea. But he said it hung down in a relaxed position so that it was 90 degrees to the long axis of the foot.
Huh.
And on the end of this appendage was about a three-quarter of an inch claw.
A claw.
But when the being walked, which was later, he saw that he took that appendage and made it parallel with the foot and just walked like a normal human being. Now, when he described this...
Was there any indication of what the use of that would have been?
No, none whatsoever. But there was something else that happened. Hubert Jarre, who was sitting there listening to the testimony, when he talked about this appendage, he sat straight up in his chair and got kind of wild-eyed. And I looked at him and I said, you know, does that mean something to you? And he said, that explains it.
All right, hold it right there. You know, I've been trying to think myself an appendage on the side of a foot that amounts to a claw. What would be the purpose of that? Well, little extra balance? Yeah, I guess it would provide that. The appendage of a predator? That might explain it. I wonder what did explain it. Doctor?
Well, I don't know if we really have an explanation, but as I said, Hubert Jarre jumped up and said, that explains it. And I said, what is it that it explains? And he said, when he went to investigate the area where the three girls saw the creature kneeling, he said he could see the impression in the ground. But just about where the foot was, there was a round hole in the ground. And he couldn't figure out what could
have been. Oh, that explains the footprint.
Right.
So, oh, then my guess is as good as any. A predator's foot. I don't know.
Well, you know, monkeys have what's called a monkey grooming claw. And when I went through all that research that we did on the Gary Lowry case with the so-called claw, we found that certain animals have claws for grooming.
Right.
Others have claws with a little canal in them that contain the gland that puts out poison. So I don't think this looks like the description of a creature that has a claw for a weapon. So
was this procedure that the doctor was doing, was all of this in some way recorded?
Were there cameras in the room? Is
that's
that the
right,
question?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
No. He said there were no military personnel in the room. They were all outside. But the intimidation was there, and he was not supposed to come out until the job was done.
God, you would think something of this magnitude, working on an alien creature, would want, you know, they would want to memorialize every second of it, if from the military point of view.
Well, I bet your bottom dollar that if it occurred here, there would have been a camera in each corner of the room, and it would have been a
you're damn right, a
sterile environment, and they wouldn't have been just wearing a scrub suit and a mask. They
right.
would have been wearing a helmet, and the air would have been evacuated, and they would have been using a rebreathing system.
I'm sure all that's true, yes, but not in Brazil.
Not in Brazil, no. Jumping to the end, the supposedly the bodies were taken to the University of Campinas, and it was that area that during the Civil War, some tunnels were dug and rooms were set up.
Wait! The bodies were taken.
Right.
Now, what? I want to know what happened to this alien.
Yeah. Okay. Let's. I just threw that in.
Well, I was afraid this alien was one of the bodies. It wasn't, was it?
Yes, unfortunately.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, now, it was there to be treated for what I thought was roughly the same thing as a broken leg or something.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So how do we get from there to dead?
Okay. Next part to the story. Part two.
Yes.
The rest of the story. The surgeon went ahead and he looked at the wound. It was a compound fracture, which means the bone was sticking through the skin.
Yeah.
And he reduced the fracture as best as possible. He approximated the bone ends. I mean, you put the bone back and you put the ends back together.
Yeah.
And then in human medicine, what we do is we take some stabilizing device, a pin, a screw, a plate, or something, and we plate it and fixate it. It's called fixating a fracture so that the thing stays, and then you close the surrounding tissue and you close the skin, and then you put a cast on it.
Normally painful but not fatal.
Normally painful, not fatal. Could be fatal if there was something like an embolus, which is a clot that forms and gets carried out through the lung. But very rare. So, our normal people...
They never told me that when I had my compound fracture. I was hang gliding, broke my arm. They never said a word about embolisms. I'll bear that in mind.
Well, how long ago was that?
I was all in my 20s, and it was the crashing part of hang gliding.
Well, since that was just yesterday, you know, we would expect to find it to be different. today, you would go in, and they would tell you everything that was going to happen to you, even having a general anesthesia that you're going to, the possibility you might die. And they would discuss embolism.
They really would talk about all of that today?
Yeah, today.
In my case, I just walked into the doctor's office. A nurse was there. He set the arm. It freaked her out so badly, she started sweating and fainted. I had so much dope in me that I didn't feel anything. And anyway, that's how that worked. I never heard a word about embolisms or anything else. So they would tell you all of that today.
Yeah, tell you all that today. And if it was an operating room, when I started this, which was a good number of years ago, we used to go into surgery, and it was very lighthearted, and it was fun. You enjoyed doing what you're doing. If you wanted to crack a joke, you cracked a joke. Today you go in, there's a camera in either corner of the room. All your conversation is being recorded. You better not smile even under your mask or somebody will detect it. And that's negligence, you know.
Today's medicine. Great. Just great. All right. Now let's not get away from this story.
Yeah, so anyway, here's the guy on the table, and he's got the fracture, and it's being set. The bone ends are put together, and the doctor's trying to decide what to use for a fixation device on an unknown creature with unknown bone. And so he goes in to look at the fracture site again and get it cleaned up, and amazingly, he can't move the ends of the bone. They don't move.
They don't move.
Can't pull them apart. So I started asking.
Meaning what? That it healed already?
It had already started to heal.
Wow.
And I asked him about the color. He said the color was pinkish, which was very the same color as a human bone. He says the bone was pretty much like human bone, except that it had these large cavities, or what he called lacunae, in the bone. And he says what that did was gave the bone a tensile strength which was much, much greater than human bone.
Uh-huh.
And made it lighter.
Okay.
Then I asked him about the blood. I said, was it blue or yellow or green? You know, what color was the blood? And he kind of chuckled at that point and said, no, it was the same color as human blood. It was red. And I asked him about the...
Did he get any samples?
Oh, yeah, they took samples, and they sent it to the lab, and they ran all kinds of tests on it. And looked for, the electrolytes and things. And he said the cellular structure was very similar to human blood, with the exception that the small white cells, the platelets, were, I think he said, tenfold over what it is in the human body.
Huh.
And he said the blood would clot almost immediately when it came out of the blood vessel. But he didn't know whether that was because of the increased number of platelets or whether the blood was being introduced into an atmosphere that was far different than what it was used to.
Well, that number of platelets might indicate a more efficient clotting and healing system, right?
Yeah, it's very possible. But it also, you know, maybe they didn't come from the same gaseous environment as we have on Earth's atmosphere. So
this man now had a sample of alien blood.
Right. Blood, sample of alien blood and bone. They sent them both to the lab. So anyway, he went ahead and, to the best of his ability, just didn't fixate it, and he closed the rest of it. And what he said happened next was the most amazing thing that he'd ever seen. He said he didn't put it into the cast because he didn't know what to expect and felt that it was safer, both for the patient and for him, because if something had happened to the patient, who knows what would happen to him.
Right.
So he watched it, and he said in a 24-hour period, everything healed, including the skin.
Okay. So right now we have a healthy, healed alien, and soon we have a dead alien. I mean, how do we get from there to there?
Okay. I said, what condition was the alien in when, or the being in when he left the hospital facility with a military guard? And he very specifically said to me he was in satisfactory medical condition. Now, that art is a very specific medical term. You talk about any dignitary or actor or actress that's reported in a hospital, and they tell you what condition. It's critical. It's satisfactory, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So when you say satisfactory condition, that means that all vital signs are present and the patient is ambulatory. That means they can walk okay and they can breathe and everything is functioning well. That is the condition that this this creature left the hospital with a military escort. He was taken immediately and put into a military truck. And from there, witnesses outside of the hospital said that the trucks left the back portion of Humanitas Hospital and immediately took him to another hospital.
Hmm.
Now, we don't know whether something transpired after it left the Hospital General or whatever the reason, but they took him to another hospital. Now, should we talk again about the last thing that happened in the operating room?
Please.
I asked the doctor, as any curious person would ask, medical and otherwise, did you have any communication with this creature?
Thank you. Yes.
He became silent. And he said, well, I'm going to tell you something that happened in the operating room. You can believe it or not. He said, when we... I almost finished the surgery, he said the room began to fill with a greenish haze. So he didn't know whether it was coming from the creature or whether it was coming from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. They didn't know whether it was going to be toxic. They didn't smell anything. And as the room filled with this greenish haze, he turned around and he saw that the source of it was the being laying on the table. He locked eyes with the creature, which he didn't want to do, and he said at this point he could not remove his eyes, and he said that it downloaded into his head, was the best way he could describe it, these thought grams, and he said it was like somebody had physically taken a rubber hammer and hit him over the head time after time after time after time, resulting in something that was akin to the worst possible migraine headache with nausea and vomiting, which lasted for over 2 weeks.
Was he being, was information being imparted with
yes.
every hit of the mallet?
Yes. So I asked him if he would tell us what this creature told him, and he said, I'm only going to tell you two things, and that were two things that it talked about in relation to the human race. And he said that it's they, wherever they or wherever they come from, felt sorry for human beings. And I said, why? And he said, for two main reasons. Number one, that human beings had the capability of doing everything that they could do. And as an example, he said, it would not be necessary for wherever he came from to be brought to a facility to have the repair done to his body that he had done here. That they could either do it singularly or they could join together and heal. And that we could do the same.
So healing would occur in a very different way. He was explaining then to the healer that otherwise this would have been done in a very different way at home,
that's
basically.
Correct.
Okay.
And the other reason was something that was quite earth-shaking. He said that human beings, he felt sorry for human beings because they were totally detached from their spiritual self.
Hmm. Some of us perhaps more than others, but that may be largely true, I suppose.
Well, I think that has a lot of deep meaning. So this takes us, you know, out the back door into a military vehicle, and he's taken to another hospital, and then within the 24-hour period... a small casket is seen being taken out of the back door of that hospital, and with him inside, as reported by medical personnel that were in the hospital.
And there's no possibility of getting information on what occurred in there?
Of course there's possibilities, greater possibilities than certainly anything that had to do with a body seen in Roswell. These people are young, and Brazilians don't like to keep their mouths shut.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So there's going to be a whole lot more to this story then, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. There's more witnesses coming forth all the time, and a little anecdotal story if we have time for it.
We do. We've got plenty of time.
The Brazilian army, the military base there at Sergeant's Camp, is a 5 day a week assignment for the officers. The officers go home; they don't stay there on base. And because you're used to going home and having an interaction with your family, your wife, mm-hmm. and so on for the weekends,
yes.
they make plans.
Sure.
So the weekend went by; the husbands didn't come home. So Monday and Tuesday.
Back away a little from your phone. You're crackling on
okay.
me.
That better?
Yes.
Monday and Tuesday, the wives were out, you know, doing the things like wives do here, getting their hair done, nails, and so on, complaining to their operators that their husbands didn't come home that weekend. And their plans were ruined. Everything that they had planned, doing this and doing that, and what kind of a lousy excuse did they have? The husbands were chasing aliens around the countryside.
So that's what they told their wives, huh?
They told the wives. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, oh, isn't that fascinating? And then all the bodies, you said, were delivered to one place?
Yes, everything was eventually wound up at the University of Campinas, which is a large university, about 40, 50 miles, I think, from Varginha. And it was at this university that the American military presence was seen.
Huh. And I suppose that's where everything terminates, more or less, once the U.S. gets involved.
Yes, yes. And there, we know also from other testimony that an autopsy was done, and we know who did it. A very famous Brazilian pathologist by the name of Baden Palares. He, if you remember, was the...
How do we know he did the autopsy?
Because the witnesses there at the university said that he was there doing the autopsy. We got the testimony. Also, he was a teacher there and held classes, and the class members knew that he was doing an autopsy on some kind of a non-human, non-terrestrial being.
Huh.
And they asked him, they pushed him, they begged him, as part of the class structure for further information, and he told them, he said, I will never talk about this in your lifetime.
So many witnesses seem to say about that, don't they?
They certainly do. So we know from there now that the stuff was taken eventually back to São Paulo, and from São Paulo, a military transport plane took everything back, undoubtedly back here somewhere, but we don't know where. Goes into the pot.
Somewhere in America, though, are the remains of those aliens.
That's correct. The Varginha aliens are somewhere in the U.S., and Lord knows how many others from somewhere else.
And so, no indication, though, of where in the U.S.?
Not a clue. Once you leave a country black like Brazil, the veil of secrecy goes up, and the information goes completely black.
All right, hold it right there. And you know, with the quality of eyewitness testimony in this case that we've heard about, for example, tonight so far with Dr. Lear, I think it's clear that in the sense that this is contemporary, there is as much, if not more, evidence of alien life in this case than there was in Roswell. At least as much as. And it's so contemporary. I mean, it virtually just happened. As the doctor pointed out, the people are young. Brazilians are given to talk about these subjects, as evidenced by their government's announcement, just to release all the information they have on ufology. hopefully it would include something of this magnitude. But in that way, it is bigger than Roswell, right, Doctor?
That certainly is. I've thought about this. I've given it some thought over and over again. I actually talked about it in the book. Certainly we touched on some of the major events of the case. And probably we should finish by saying that the story does not end with the events of the week of January the 20th or the...
In what sense?
The death of the military police officer, because 3 months later, an individual who was giving a party at the local Virginia Zoo in a small room, which I visited, in a secluded area of the zoo. The zoo is very jungle-like in Virginia. And she stepped out on the porch during this little party and decided to have a cigarette. So she lit up a cigarette, and as she turned to light the cigarette, she looked and saw staring at her from the upper level of the porch a creature looking at her, which she described exactly the same way as the other eyewitnesses in the Virginia case, except that this creature, she said, was wearing some kind of short helmet that was gold in color.
Is there any way for the witnesses... Did they manage to discern? I mean, you told me quite a bit, but did they come to some conclusion about whether these beings were benign or whether they had, well, I don't know, evil in some kind of bad intent toward us?
There was no indication by any of the witnesses that any of the creatures that were involved in the capture by the Brazilian military, or seen by civilian witnesses, did anything to provoke anybody. Certainly, the creature that the two military police officers stopped to help and one to pick up and take in his car, it was very evident that he gave almost no resistance whatsoever. Even the creatures that the Brazilian army and fire department chased through the clearing into the little woods, only seemed to be running from them. They did not seem to be hostile in any way. And if one of them was shot, again, we don't know exactly what happened because the witnesses could not see what happened in the little forested area.
Doctor, what about evidence after the fact? I mean, for example, blood samples. That would be extremely convincing evidence, I would think.
Well, here's my hope, Art. I made a very sincere promise to the orthopedic surgeon that I would not reveal his name.
Okay, but still, if you have blood, you have a DNA structure, for example, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So here's
the deal. I didn't get any reports. I didn't see any x-rays. I wasn't able to bring back anything, but... I gave this man my word. I would not reveal his name because he was terrified. And I think now, at this late date, with all these things going on, if I went back there,
yes,
it's got to be somebody made a copy of the lab report.
You're damn right. Are you going to go back?
Yes. I'm going to try and get down there before the end of the year.
And is your intent, you have intent to come back with that kind of, I mean, that kind of evidence would rock the world, Doctor.
Yeah, well, I think, there's a greater chance from what's going on here, what's going on now, that, we could possibly get this evidence. Because if the Brazilian Air Force is turning this material over and it's going to become public knowledge, then somebody who has one of these documents say, okay, it's public knowledge, here, take it. Yours.
So your expectation of this announcement, this timely announcement, I might add, by the Brazilian government, they're going to let everything loose. You don't expect it to include this?
Personally, no. But But the people who might have something, you know, without it coming from the government or from the military, they might decide, well, look, you know, the Air Force is letting stuff go, you know. Maybe these documents I took home, hey, I'll let people take a look at it.
All right. A couple of very quick questions. You're on the air with Dr. Roger Lear. Where are you calling from, please?
Hi, I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
Portland. And you have a question?
Yeah, I didn't catch the very beginning of this. When did this happen?
When did the incident occur? You're right. You didn't catch the beginning. You might want to catch the replay. It was a very intense story, and I trust they'll replay it at the end of the program tonight, hopefully in your market. All right, doctor?
January the 20th of 1996.
And it occurred over a period of how many hours or days, would you say, actively going
on?
The
intense activity took place from the night of January the 19th through the 22nd.
Through the 22nd. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Roger Lear. Good morning.
Hi, my name's Katina. I'm from Greenville, South Carolina.
Yes.
My question was more about the gentleman who caught the illness. My sister recently passed away with an illness that was incredibly similar to the one the doctor described. She had an infection in her blood. She had pneumonia. She had the areas on her skin. But she is not active in the military or anything like that. As far as I know, she's never had any, like, you know, abductions or anything of that sort.
And what was the cause of death in her case listed as?
Same kind of thing. She just had an autopsy.
No. In this case, there was no cause of death listed. Not really. So what specifically was said about your sister?
Okay. Well, every time they did an extraction of the material or bacteria or infection that was in her body,
yes,
they never could get anything to grow so they could study it. They never were able to identify it.
Wow. Well, that is pretty weird, doctor.
I'd like to know if someone received a death certificate.
I mean, she just passed away the 16th. So,
of this month?
Yes, just recently.
Well, it would be interesting to see what it says on the death certificate as the cause of death, because in the United States, no matter what state you're in, to meet all the legal qualifications, a cause of death must be listed.
Okay. Well, she also had, like, the abscess.
Yes, we've got that. Will you please contact us with that information when you get it?
I will definitely do that.
All right. Thank you very much, and take care. God, you wouldn't want to think, would you, doctor, that something like that is loose in some way?
Well, how do we know? You know, the whole abduction phenomena, for example, people are very reticent to talk about it. They have, you know, many fears. Seven traumas is what Dr. Mack listed in his book, Abduction. So who in the world is going to talk about death, you know, following an abduction scenario?
No, you're quite right. Sure. Sure. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Roger Lear. Good morning.
Hi, this is Karen from Sacramento.
Karen, you're going to have to yell at us. You're not too loud. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Better.
Okay. Yeah, I missed it when you came back from break, when the doctor looked at the guy's claw on the foot and said, now I understand. What did he understand?
Huh. We did cover that, but nevertheless, doctor?
What Ubejara Rodriguez, the chief investigator in the case, was so shocked about, I had to do with the fact that when he examined the area where the creature was kneeling by the wall, if he found a little round hole in the ground at the area where the foot was, and that was the explanation, because it was probably this appendage that made the little round hole.
Okay, well, that should do it. Let's go to first-time caller line. You're on the air with Dr. Roger Lear. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi. What is your first name? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hello.
It's me, Amanda.
Amanda. And where are you, Amanda?
I'm on the North Carolina, South Carolina line.
Way back there, okay.
And I've been waiting for a show like this.
Well, here it is.
I have a question. I'd like to ask Dr. Lear to give some more information on the implants he's removed. And I also think I have implants.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's a whole nother show, and we've done shows on the implants, but briefly, doctor, if you want to It is something you do. You remove these implants. I think perhaps publicly at least you've removed more, and probably even in private, than any other doctor in the world of these sorts of suspected things, right?
That's correct, Art. And I've been in practice for 41 years, and before I ever got involved with the abduction phenomena or UFOs and this nature, I've extracted hundreds of things from the human foot, from paper to glass to hair to nails to whatever. And in all cases, I can honestly say I was only interested in two things. One was whether it came out satisfactory and it was all gone, or if there was any lesions in the area to know that they were benign and healed. I never gave any thought to what these objects might be. But in answer to the lady's question, we've now done 11 cases which produced 12 objects, and 11 of these have had scientific interest, very most unusual findings. I can still refer you to my first book, The Aliens and the Scalpel, which I think you can still get on Amazon.com, or Casebook Alien Implants, I think is still available on the bookstores. I'm coming out with a second edition of the first book. So,
have you come to any conclusions, Doctor, about the implants themselves, whether they're active, essentially, and controlling in some way, or simple listening and monitoring devices, or what?
I think they're, first of all, a form of advanced nanotechnology, and the purpose might be to transmit biological data that has to do with our changing DNA. And I don't have nowhere near the time. To go into all the details that made me reach that conclusion. But I usually don't like to jump out and give answers for something that, you know, is conjecture. But scientifically, you can advance a theory, but it has to be taken into the laboratory and either proven or disproven. But at the present time, at the present date, 2005, after doing quite a few of these, that is my present feeling.
All right, you sure have, with everything you've told us tonight, earned a book plug, UFO Crash in Brazil. And we've been talking about it all night tonight, the UFO Crash in Brazil, this one, is available in this country now. It's on Amazon. Could I go cruising to Amazon and get it?
You should be able to. Or you can get it by calling an 800 number.
Okay.
Which is 800-700-8733. Or you can go through my website, alienscalpel.com, mm-hmm. alienscalpel.com. Or you can call 805-495-2613, and you can get a personalized copy. And if you say...
You'll sign it.
Right. I'll sign it, make it to whoever is ordering it, and if you say you've heard it on Coast to Coast with Art Bell, it's only $1 shipping and handling.
Oh, my gosh. All right, that last number where you can get the personalized version, let's have that again.
805-495-2613.
Oh, that's a good deal. Is that a number that you have to answer personally?
It'll either be answered by my secretary or by an answering device.
I see. And how much is the book?
The book is $14.95.
$14.95. Well, my guess is it's going to sell like hotcakes. With what's going on, it just couldn't be better, and I'm sure you must have jumped for joy when you heard the story about Brazil breaking in the press.
Couldn't believe it, and just as I said, another synchronicity, the way my life has been going.
I'm willing to bet you that the nightly news will probably pick this up. East of the Rockies, not a lot of time, but a question if you have it for Dr. Lear.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering if anyone knew the approximate weight of the creature.
The approximate weight, okay. Well, it was small, we know that. Doctor, weight?
Don't have an answer. I don't even remember if I asked that question, because I don't know if there would have been time enough for any medical personnel to have weighed the creature.
Would be interesting, though. It would tell us something about density, I suppose, huh?
That it would. I would be very, very much. That was an excellent question.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Roger Lear. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Gary listening in on San Diego here, COGO, AM 600.
Well, of course.
Dr. Lear, I'm a friend with Dr. Stephen Greer, and we probably had a representative visit to you. His name is Dan from Hypertech. Anyway, my question is, now I know they're going to put these documents on the Internet somehow, but I think it would be a good idea if it had some officiation coming from the Brazilian government and posted on the Internet. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a fact, huh? Although whether we could expect that, even with this latest announcement, I don't know. Doctor?
I don't know. Taking a poke at this time. I mean, we know what's happened. I haven't seen it. I know that AJ is getting it translated into English because all the documents are written in Portuguese. So anything that's posted is going to have to be a translation. But the documents that I brought back from Brazil, signed by the Brazilian authorities, were in Portuguese, and I had them translated into English.
Do you think there'd be a way do you even hope to go down there, for example, and come back with a blood sample? I mean, that would just blow the lid off the whole world, because obviously there'd be presumably different DNA. I mean, the blood would be the smoking gun.
Oh, sure. You know, can it be done? Yeah. You know, somebody's got to have something somewhere. And don't tell me, you know, that they did as good as they would do here. I mean, even the report by the farmer talking about how the Brazilian military across the field, I'm sure with the training that's being done here with our military groups for crash retrieval, far surpasses what they ever did there. There may be something still laying in that field.
When might you go back?
Well, sometime between now and the end of the year, there's a couple of things that are coming up.
Doctor, we're out of time. I've got to go. Brother, what a show. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me, Art.
Have a good night. There you have it. Classic stuff. Dr. Roger Lear from the High Desert. I'm Art Bell. Hope you have a great week. Good night.